Welcome to Crash Concepts, where the economy, energy, and the environment are explored. Up next, fresh ideas and insights into the factors that are driving the world and shaping your future. Presenting information you can't afford to live without, here's Chris Martinson.
Welcome, everyone, to this Featured Voices podcast at Peak Prosperity. I'm your host, Chris Martinson, and it is June 5th, 2019. Now, as you probably know, I'm an enormous, huge, gigantic critic of the central banks. Once the lenders of last resort to stressed banks with good collateral, the central banks are kind of now daily interlopers in equity and bond markets across the globe and feel they can apply monetary solutions to almost every economic problem. And every single time, magically, those solutions mean more money printed up and looser financial conditions. It's not too much to say that everybody listening to this is part of a gigantic, never-before-seen social and monetary experiment being conducted by a few people at the central banks. Now, what's missing is any connection to the real economy and to real, tangible things. So what's an investor to do? Well, heck, what's somebody to do who simply wants to avoid having their purchasing power stolen away by central bank printing presses? Well, that's easy. You just hold real assets. And perhaps the simplest and certainly the most liquid of them all is gold, which we've been advocating people hold as a portion in their portfolios for well over a decade now. And good news, today we are going to be discussing gold with Roni Sterfeli of Incrementum, a firm which offers wealth management and investment funds. Gold has been on a bit of a tear the past 5 days. This morning, I'm looking at my charts here. It's at a multi-month high of $1,346 an ounce, in U.S. dollars, of course, after bottoming out around $1,170 last August in 2018. So will it go higher? If so, what's the investment thesis? Now, this is where Roni's firm really delivers the goods. Each year, at the end of May, Incrementum's research team delivers the most comprehensive report on gold to be found anywhere in the world and then releases it for free to the public. It's a huge educational service for everyone. Roni is partner of Incrementum AG and responsible for research and portfolio management. Roni studied business administration and finance in the USA and at the Vienna University of Economics and Business Administration, and he also gained work experience at the trading desk of a bank during his studies. Upon graduation, he joined the research department of Erst Group, where he published his first In Gold We Trust report in 2007. Now, over the years, the Gold Report has proceeded to become one of the benchmark publications on gold, money, inflation, monetary policy. We're going to look at all of that stuff today. Roni's married. He's the proud father of three daughters. He likes to spend his spare time with his family, watching and playing football, running, and at classical concerts. Welcome, Roni. It's good to have you to the program.
Hi, Chris. Hi. Thanks for having me again.
Yeah, you know, I first met you in person in Munich, and you treated me to a very nice lunch at a traditional Bavarian cafe. I remember that all very fondly.
Yes. We had a really nice meal without any traditional Bavarian or Munich beer, unfortunately, because we had to work afterwards. But it was a really nice conversation. I really enjoyed meeting you.
Yeah. Just that one missing detail, but otherwise just perfect. It was So I consider you to be a friend and a colleague and certainly a compatriot in these times where we're working very hard to educate people about what's really going on. So let's start with this year's big, shiny new In Gold We Trust report. Just give people a little history, how it came about, and in very broad terms, how big is it and how widely is it being read?
Yeah, well, we actually hit a new all-time high this year. We wrote more than 340 pages. So every year we sit together in fall and discuss the content of the next gold report, and we say, we have to try writing a bit less, and then we end up with more and more pages every year. But there's just so many different things to write about, and just to give you a brief brief summary of the content. We're writing, of course, about the development of gold in different currencies. We're writing about technical analysis. We're writing about the de-dollarization. We're writing about hyperinflation. We've got a great guest comment by Keith Wiener about gold bonds, bringing back an extinguisher of debt to the bond market. We compare gold to Bitcoin. We write about mining stocks and what's going on in the mining industry. We're writing about gold storage. We're writing about portfolio characteristics, especially how gold performs in different stages of a recession. We've got a fantastic exclusive interview with Fofoa. I don't know if you and your listeners are familiar to Free Gold. That is one of the most interesting blogs out there from a real central bank insider. So there is as a special, there is a 40-page interview with Fofoa, the blogger. Then we're writing about China quite extensively because China is nowadays the biggest producer but also consumer of gold. And starting in 2019, we are going to publish the report not only in English and in German, but also in Chinese. So there will be a Mandarin translation. So yeah, 340 pages. So you at least have to reserve a weekend to work through the report. But there is also a compact version of the In Gold We Trust, which is still 100 pages. So yeah, I think it's if you really want to know what's going on in the space, I think this should be one of the few reads every year, and you get the full package of information.
Well, it's so comprehensive, and there is a lot to cover because finance and economics touches all sorts of different areas, and gold has had this central role for a really long time. And I know some people think, oh, you know, Chris, it's the barbarous relic. It's just this inert metal. We've got cryptocurrencies. We're going to talk about the relationship between those two in a second. But let's just back up a second and look at I think what your core motif is, as I read through the front of this, is really around crumbling trust. And one of the things that is a central pillar of our financial system right now and all debt-based fiat currencies is trust. There has to be trust in the system, right? You have to trust that your central bank isn't going to overdo it or do something really stupid. You have to have a lot of different pieces of trust, and you have to have trust that the reserve currency is going to be well managed. So take us through that piece of how trust plays a role in all this and why you think it's crumbling.
Well, I always like to start discussion with a definition, and the definition of trust is the firm belief in the reliability, truth, ability, or strength of someone or something. Mm-hmm. And from my point of view, trust is very often underestimated because many people think that trust is for granted, but basically all human interactions are based on trust. When we visited the restaurant in Munich, we trusted, you know, that the cook will not use any spoiled ingredients, that he ensures cleanliness of the whole preparation, and that he eventually makes us a really good dish. We trust when we trust the airline company and the pilot when we sit on a plane. We trust other people in traffic when we get into our car. So there's many, many different areas in life where trust is really, I would say, that the basis of all human interaction. And when it comes to money, of course, trust is also crucial. And I have to tell you, back in 2007, when I was a young analyst sitting in a bank, and I thought, okay, I want to write about gold and what would be a good title, and I came up with In Gold We Trust, I actually didn't understand the meaning and the importance of that title. And now over the years, I read quite a lot of books about trust and how trust is established, and also how trust is destroyed, and it's highly asymmetrical. So it takes ages to build up trust, for example, in relationships, in business relationships. And then it just takes, you know, seconds sometimes to destroy this trust. And from my point of view, the trust in the monetary system is still pretty high, especially given the fact that we are all part of huge monetary experiments. Mm-hmm. And I think the trust in the US economy and in the Federal Reserve is still pretty high. We're seeing the mantra of deficits don't matter at the moment, and everybody thinks that the US dollar is, the least dirty shirt. But from my point of view, this trust is crumbling, and we have seen the last couple of weeks that the recession clouds are getting darker. And from my point of view, there is no doubt that the Federal Reserve and central banks in general will step in with very, very aggressive measures if the recession clouds should become darker. And this is actually what we're seeing at the moment. And it is no coincidence that in the last couple of weeks, there were some papers, very, very sophisticated papers coming out from the Federal Reserve, for example, mentioning that negative rates would be quite favorable and would have positive effects. There were some comments from Donald Trump, of course, on the Fed policy. So the Fed should cut rates by 1% and do more QE. Then there was, of course, some representatives saying that, you know, not only negative rates, but also additional measures like, you know, controlling the yield curve should be considered. So from my point of view, in the next couple of weeks, we will see that this monetary U-turn that already began in December, this will continue. And this is actually the reason why gold has reacted so positively the last couple of weeks. And from my point of view, we are in this central bank trap, the zero interest rate trap. We just published a book in German, which is called The Zero Interest Rate Trap. And there is no way out. And from my point of view, gold is a pretty, pretty good hedge in this kind of environment.
Indeed. And so let's go. I love that idea that trust takes decades to build and seconds to destroy. It is very asymmetrical in that regard. And that's true in our personal relationships. But I lost my trust in the central banks a long time ago when I simply started to look at what they were doing and why they were doing it. And I think that this whole idea that the direction they've pushed us all into is really a trap, right? There's no possible way for interest rates to renormalize at this point, given the levels of debt that are out there and given the financial conditions of various companies, BBB debts, junk debts, yeah. Sovereign debts. It's just there's so much debt in the system. And their classic mistake, the blunder they made, was thinking that that somehow they confused asset price inflation with real prosperity. And they encouraged financialization as an activity. So corporations bought bad stocks, but they didn't invest in property, plant, and equipment. So they just confused money with wealth. And that's, I think, the classic blunder of them all. Money and wealth are very separate things, but gold has been considered both money and wealth for millennia. If you could, Ronnie, gold, I mean, really, in some respects, you might say it's been going nowhere for like 5 or 6 years. It's been recently exciting. But what role does it still play in someone's portfolio at this point?
Well, it should play an important role from my point of view, but of course I'm definitely not really representative for the mainstream investor. And I think, you know, Chris, there's a big difference when it comes to the thinking over here in Europe, mm-hmm. Where let's say our monetary DNA is probably very, very much influenced by the hyperinflation that we experienced in Austria, where I come from, but also in Germany with the Weimar Republic hyperinflation, which of course laid the foundation for Adolf Hitler. Compared to the US, where the Great Depression and the deflationary developments definitely also influence the thinking and the philosophy of the Federal Reserve, where really this is everything that they they want to avoid. And you know, Ben Bernanke was very, very vocal about that. And he basically spent all his academic career studying the Great Depression and putting out those papers, suggesting ideas how to navigate in such an environment. Now, I think when it comes to gold from a portfolio perspective, this is a concept that we already presented in 2006, and I think it's still highly relevant, because from my point of view, I am, you know, I'm traveling quite a lot, doing keynote speeches all over the globe about gold, about inflation, about mining stocks, and it seems that there's basically three different groups then that can be characterized, and when it comes to gold at the moment, I think that investors' demand is really basically the demand that will make a difference, because we haven't seen any investors' demand the last couple of years, but this will really be the crucial difference going forward. So those three groups are the believers. For them, you know, they've got very high trust in the status quo. They think that, you know, the Federal Reserve and the central banks, they did a terrific job. So we're just in a bit of a longer recession or downturn. We are already on the road to recovery. Everything takes a bit longer. The whole healing process takes longer, but everything is basically fine. They probably also believe in, you know, in Santa Claus and in the Tooth Fairy, and this is fine. I always tell my kids those stories, and they love it. But you know, we could say it's kind of a conspiracy story, but. You know, they believe in it, and that's fine for me. Yeah? So the first group, those are the believers. And this is probably still one of the biggest groups. Then there's the skeptics. Those are people who kind of had initial doubts about the recovery, but they regained trust in the status quo because asset prices were rising. You know, we are in this everything bubble. So it's not only equities doing very well. It is also, of course, bonds doing extremely well, corporate bonds, but also sovereign debt. We're seeing real estate all over the globe going crazy. We're seeing that the art market is running really hot. So it is not only equities that rose significantly due to these monetary injections. It is basically every asset class. So this definitely fueled this asset price inflation that you referred to before. So for this group, the skeptics, I think they are very pragmatic when it comes to gold. And for them, they're, you know, within the financial markets and within the industry, you've got this, let's say, cover your ass policy. You've got for many fund managers, for example, they are not able, or they do not really they're not really able to take contrarian positions. They rather go with the mainstream. So for them, I think they're sitting on the sidelines at the moment, but they want to enter gold, because the fourth quarter 2018, when basically all asset markets were down, I think this was a big warning shot for financial market participants. We have seen December was the worst performance since the Great Depression. And in the fourth quarter, every asset class was down, but gold was up 7% and mining stocks were up 17%. So fourth quarter 2018 was really, really important. Now, the second group, I think as soon as we go above this 1360, 1380 resistance, I think they will really, really start buying gold. And this will really move the market. And then the third groups, those are the critics. And I think both of us are in this camp. Those are people that kind of question the viability of the status quo. So for us, there is a systemic error in the structure of our monetary system. We know that all the rescues and the measures that were taken in the last couple of years, they only address the symptoms, but not the root cause of our problem. Mm-hmm. So I think it's important to make this distinction. And the beauty of it is, Chris, it is a one-way street. So you will never go from the critics' camp back to the believers' camp and say, you know what the Federal Reserve is doing now with more QE and lower rates, this will probably make everything better and this will heal everything and everything is going to be fine. So people will come from the camp of the skeptics to the critics. They will go from the believers to the skeptics. And this should have some sort of natural demand for gold. And it's pretty interesting that we have seen in institutional demand quite recently in GLD, the biggest gold ETF, we saw the biggest single day asset inflow since the Brexit. So those trend followers are coming into the market again. And I think this is really going to be interesting the next couple of weeks. And from my point of view, if we go above this massive resistance that has been very, very tough to crack, we failed 5 or 6 times on a weekly chart. I think then we can go to 1500, 1600 pretty quickly.
Well, let's take the trend followers. You know, I love watching the people pile in, pile out. And so maybe those got, people, I don't know which class to put them in, maybe skeptics or something, but let's talk about the fundamental case for gold here. This is something I've been tracking for a while. You've got some really exciting stuff in here as well. And of course, we know some things. You know, I want to talk about gold mining. You know, there's a case was made a number of years back, maybe 2 years ago, about peak gold from a mining standpoint. We know that China's still accumulating. China has a very different love affair with gold. So does Europe compared to the U.S. We're honestly, I got to be honest, Ronnie, almost every article written about gold in the U.S. still bashes it subtly or not so subtly, right? It's just very much a psychological operation running against gold for whatever reason. So it's a little bit held in disdain in the U.S., but it's loved in Asia and India as well. So let's talk about that fundamental case, including maybe central banks and their buying. What are you seeing there from that standpoint?
Well, I would say that first of all, we should not forget that 70% of all physical gold demand is coming from emerging markets. So I'm quite often in Asia, and if you talk to investors in Singapore, in Hong Kong, in Shanghai, for them, you know, talking about gold is totally different than compared to Western investors. They mm-hmm. they don't really care about the daily noise. They're in for the long game. They know what gold does for your portfolio, that it is an asset without any counterparty risk. And this is really one of the most important characteristics of gold, obviously. They know that it's a good hedge against the US dollar. They know that it is an asset that was basically worked the last 5,000 years. So for them, they've got a completely different attitude when it comes to gold. So 70% of all physical demand nowadays is coming from Asia. That's really important. Now, it is not only institutional demand and private demand, it is also this de-dollarization topic. So last year, we have seen the highest gold demand since the end of the Bretton Woods Agreement in 1971. So central banks all over the globe bought 650 tons of gold in 2018. The largest, by far the largest buyer was Russia, buying 270 tons. Then it was Kazakhstan, it was India, but there were also countries within the European Union like Hungary or Poland buying gold. The Chinese bought gold, and we all know that they bought much, much more than officially published. Mm-hmm. So I think this de-dollarization trend that we are writing about for already 4 years, this is really going mainstream now. I had interviews with Bloomberg, for example, 2 or 3 years ago. If I would told them about de-dollarization, they couldn't care less about this topic. But now I think the world realizes, also because of this lack of trust or crumbling trust in international policy alliances or whatever, and the increasing tensions that we are seeing geopolitically, not only between China and the US, but also between many other nations. I think this is a very strong additional case for this de-dollarization trend, and this is the reason why it picks up momentum in the last couple of a month. And I think this is something that Donald Trump is really concerned about. And I think that I'm absolutely certain that we won't see a quick deal regarding the trade negotiations with China, because China doesn't want a quick deal. And from my point of view, I'm not sure if Donald Trump wants a deal really quickly, because he needs some momentum for the election year. So I think this will be a topic that will become more and more important. And if we look below the surface, it's not about trade. It is, from my point of view, it's primarily about currencies. Nowadays, everybody wants to devalue its currency. Nobody wants a strong currency because, you know, a strong currency is something like a fitness program for your economy. And we wrote about that quite extensively. It is no coincidence that mostly hard currency nations like Switzerland, but also like Germany and Austria, are very prosperous, because a strong currency and a hard currency makes you work harder, be more innovative, be closer to your clients, and deliver better products. And from my point of view, this devaluation race that we're in, those currency wars, those will become more important. And of course, gold does not participate in those currency wars. And therefore, I think that, you know, this is a topic that emerging markets realized, but we all and they address this by buying gold, by significantly buying gold. But we've also seen that industrialized nations, they stopped selling their gold in 2008 and 2009. And the fact that now there's even some countries within the European Union aggressively buying central bank gold, I think this is a really big sign and the paradigm shift that we're in at the moment.
Very well said. You know, at the highest level, the trust is that you have to trust that that your currency will be able to buy something, right? So there has to be a relationship between the claims, which is currency, and also debt. Those are claims, and the real stuff, right? All the things we want to buy, our houses, vacations, whatever those things are. And when those things get out of balance, as you mentioned, the famous Austrian inflation. So, you know, Europe is going to fight that last monster, which was inflation. And in the United States, we I guess our big last monster that really scared us was deflation. So we're fighting different monsters, but everybody's kind of doing it the same way by printing like crazy. And that starts to erode that trust. That's at the high level. And then at the more specific level, I think what's interesting, what you're raising, is the United States has been the world's reserve currency. It's probably still, I don't know, 62% of all reserve assets out there in currency form. I might be off a percent or two, but I think that's about right. And yeah. And the United States has been using that very heavily as a weapon. It's weaponized it, right? Cutting people off from SWIFT transactions, yeah, and punishing countries that, you know, want to, like, say, trade with Iran because we didn't like a deal on a treaty, you know, that got signed that we didn't like or something like that. So without that trust that you can believe in the contract that it's going to be fulfilled, that does begin to erode. And so a very interesting point you've made, which is that gold is a way, and a very important way, because it's unanchored from the currency wars, because everybody's fighting that. Everybody wants a weaker currency. And at the same time, they don't want to be exposed to two things. One, the dollar. Two, to the idea that currencies, that erosion of currency power loss can really bite you. So that hedge of gold in a national portfolio feels kind of the same. But some of those same reasons are why I hold it in my personal portfolio.
Yeah, I mean, I think it is pretty interesting to quote what the Hungarian National Bank said, and basically in their first gold purchase since the year 1986, and let me read that up. The Hungarian Central Bank. It seems that the readers of the In Gold We Trust report, so they wrote, in normal circumstances, gold has a confidence-building feature. It may play a stabilizing role and act as a major line of defense under extreme market conditions or in times of structural changes in the international financial system or a deep geopolitical crisis. In addition, gold continues to be one of the safest assets which can be related to individual properties such as the limited supply of physical precious metal, which is not linked with credit or counterparty risk, given that gold is not a claim on a specific counterparty or country. Isn't that... I mean, that's just great. That's just perfect.
Thank you for bringing that up, because I could have written that. You could have written that. That's coming from a central bank. Go hungry. Yeah, that's very good.
So I think, you know, what you refer to, mentioning SWIFT, that's really important that the US is using it basically as a weapon. And Vladimir Putin said, we aren't ditching the dollar, but the dollar is ditching us. So I think it's really important to say that it's not only, you know, this axis of gold like Russia, China, Kazakhstan, Turkey that is referring to this de-dollarization. It is also the European Union, for example. There's Jean-Claude Juncker, the president of the European Commission. He said it is absurd that Europe pays for 80% of its energy import bill, which is worth 300 billion euro a year, in US dollars, when only roughly 2% of our energy imports come from the US. It is absurd that European companies buy European planes in dollars instead of euro. The euro must become the face and the instrument of a new, more sovereign Europe. So that's not like a small blogger from some random place. It is basically the head of the European Union making those comments. And I think this is really what I've said before. This is really a sign that this de-dollarization is gaining momentum now. And Donald Trump, I think, you know, when they did the trade deal with South Korea, explicitly. There were currency terms negotiated, and I think we all don't know what's going on behind the curtains and on the negotiations between China and the US. But we all know that the big guys, the most important countries, they already have significant gold reserves. It is the US holding more than 8,000 tons of gold. It is the Eurozone holding more than 10,000 tons of gold. And interestingly, the Eurozone is valuing the gold reserve mark to market. So they're updating the value on the balance sheet of the ECB on a quarterly basis, mark to market. I think this is pretty interesting, especially compared to the US. It is China holding more than 2,000 tons. It is Russia holding more than 2,000 tons. The IMF holds more than 3,000 tons. So the most important players, they already got significant amounts of gold in their vaults. And from my point of view, at some point there will be a revaluation of the gold price. And actually, if you read and if you study monetary history, in those transition phases from one currency to another, from one world leading currency to another, gold always played a major role. And I think the next time it will be probably pretty similar.
You know, a piece of analysis that really stuck with me over the years was by Grant Williams about gold, and he titled it Nobody Cares.
Yeah.
And I'm sure you're familiar with it, of course. And for people listening, his thesis was that when you talk to people in the United States in particular, they don't care about gold. Nobody at the Treasury Department's thinking about it. And, you know, it's just sort of this afterthought. But the truth is, when you look at a lot of the data and the analysis, I like the stuff that Koos Jansen and Ronan Manley have done at Bullion Star to track the flows of gold. Where is it coming from? Because here's the fun thing about gold. You can't print it up. So if there's a deficit, that means that it came out of somebody's vault somewhere to make that up. And according to their research, Roni, that there's been a pretty big deficit of gold in the West and a pretty big surplus of gold flowing to the East. That has to be coming out of somebody's vaults. Did you take a look at that and have a position on, and the reason I'm asking this question is because it feels like, I think the West will begin to care about gold when the vaults get a little bit bare and they want to stop the flow. And there's only a couple of ways to do that. And the most important one is raise the price, right? So do you have a sense of that flow of gold from West to East and where we are in that process?
Yeah, well, I mean, you mentioned Koos Jansen and Ronan Manley, who are doing terrific jobs on that. And it's pretty obvious that gold is flowing from the West to the East. And this is something that we have also, you know, seen in history all the time. So we have seen that, for example, in the Roman Empire, we have seen that basically in all big shifts of the international economy, we have seen those developments, and from my point of view, you're totally right that price will probably as always make the difference, but the question is if gold now goes from weak hands to strong hands, the big question is at what price will those strong hands become sellers again? And from what I know, from discussions with Chinese friends, with friends from India, from Vietnam, and so on, we would have to have a significantly higher price that they would even consider selling their gold again, because for them, and this is also the approach that I really follow. I mean, it would be, I would most appreciate the fact if I would never have to need my gold as a monetary insurance, and if I could inherit it to my kids. And this is, I think, also the approach of many Asian investors, where we are seeing that, okay, they as I've mentioned before, they're really in for the long game, and they don't care about the short term price movements. I think there's a great quote by John Morrill. He said, like liberty, gold never stays where it is undervalued. And as I've said, we've seen that with the Romans. They realized this more than 2,000 years ago, when the Chinese and the Indians accepted only gold and not Roman goods in exchange for spices and silk. So the fact that emerging markets in 2020 will already be 50% of world GDP, while this number was 19% in the year 2000, and that we're seeing that they're constantly buying gold as an insurance and as an investment, I think this perfectly makes the case for future rising prices. And actually, I think this is something that people completely underestimate. Gold is trading at or close to all-time highs in so many currencies at the moment. Just have a look at the Canadian dollar. Just have a look at the Australian dollar. Gold is trading at all-time highs. Have a look at gold in many emerging market currencies. Gold is trading at all-time highs. Since the euro was established as book money, gold is up 370%. So on an annualized basis, gold rose since 1999 almost 8%. But still, everybody is still looking at the dollar price of gold. And from my point of view, we have seen dollar strength in the last couple of years, of course. The main reason was that the Federal Reserve was basically the only important central bank that was able to raise rates. But now with this monetary U-turn that I referred to, I think this interest rate differential will shrink, and this should also be the nail in the coffin for the US dollar.
Yeah, very well said. So let's talk then very quickly about this idea that, so here's the theory I have. I have this theory that because nobody cares, and by nobody I mean it's the big money, right? We don't, I'm not aware of any pension funds investing in gold from the United States, maybe a couple, but not really, not the big ones. I'm not aware of endowments having a lot of exposure. I'm not aware of big families. Like, as we all know, like silver, let's imagine there's 1 billion ounces of buyable silver in the world. That means that basically 1/10 of Jeff Bezos's post-divorce, haul could buy all the silver in the world. One dude, right? So here's my thesis. While nobody cares, people like myself, I'll call myself the retail investor, right? I can get access to gold and silver. But that when that phase shift happens and when there's a lot of interest in gold and silver, I think retail investors are going to have a hard time potentially getting their hands in gold and silver just because of the asymmetry of power in this structure. You know, once billionaires decide they have to get their hands in gold and silver, well, they have access to LBMA vaults. I don't, potentially, right? So what are your thoughts about that? Do you think there's a risk at some point where when everybody suddenly cares again that the average investor will have a harder time participating?
I don't think so. I mean, we've had that in 2011 when gold was at 1900. Of course, there were at some points there were people lining up in front of the coin dealers, and over here in Europe, for example, I think that's a pretty big difference. It is totally normal to buy gold coins and bars at a branch of a bank, for example. Yeah, it's just go into the bank and say, okay, I want to buy 10 Philharmonic coins or 10 Krugerrands or whatever. And we have seen that at some stages there was very high demand, but we haven't seen any real scarcity. And of course, I think if our thesis is right, that we're moving from this based on a Dow theory, we have been in the accumulation phase and now we're entering the public participation phase, which is the longest and the most interesting one. And then, of course, then there is this mania phase at the very end. If we're right and we're entering this public participation phase, of course, there will be more demand in silver, for example. At the moment, nobody cares about silver. It's a tiny market, but we all know if gold picks up momentum, silver will probably outperform gold by at least 3-1. We know that people will start buying mining stocks again. We have seen this merger mania in the mining space, and I think that many companies, not all, but many, did a tremendous job. We have seen this creative destruction, according to Schumpeter, in the last couple of years in the mining space. So there will be new demand from generalist investors coming into the mining space. And of course, you know, as the bull market progresses, people will take more leverage, they will become more aggressive, they will pile into the juniors, for example, they will go into more speculative forms of buying gold. But from my point of view, there's basically two different ways how to invest in gold and two different motivations. First of all, there's Sicherheitsgold in German. It would be safety or security gold. It is really as a hedge for worst case scenarios like hyperinflation, financial repression, a currency reform, whatever. Then you want to have physical gold. Then you want to have as little counterparty risk as possible. And then there is, of course, the speculation aspect. Yeah, you can buy performance gold, you can buy mining stocks, you can buy options, whatever. But never make the mistake to, you know, hedge against monetary worst case scenarios, hyperinflation, whatever, and then buy a certificate issued by a big bank that just wants to kind of outperform the price of gold. That doesn't make any sense, because when really the shit hits the fan, you don't want to have lots of counterparty risk. So those two different motivations, I think they are really important. And from my point of view, when it comes to physical gold, there shouldn't be any real lack of supply. And normally, if there is lack of supply, normally the price will solve this problem. So at some point, I'm going to become a seller. At the moment, I'm on the buying side, of course. But at some point, I'm going to be a seller. So if there's a real market, and we can discuss that, of course, then I think that prices will take care of it.
Well, let's discuss that. Do we have a real market in gold?
Do we have a real market in general?
All right. I've been arguing for a while on Twitter. Bad place to argue, but I've been putting up a little meme where I say, financial markets are now government operated utilities. Change my mind, right? And so that's a point I've been taking for a while, which is that the markets are now so big, so important, tail wags the dog now that of course they're not left to chance. And gold is a very important signaling element. And of course, some would say that's not left to chance. And we have lots of history to say London gold pool, et cetera, and so forth, where it hasn't been left to chance. But now people would argue, oh, nobody cares about gold. So, of course, it's not officially, you know, even looked at, let alone manipulated. But of course, that's one aspect of it. And the second is the structure of the market. And this isn't just related to gold and silver. But when you look at how all commodities trade, and this extends to other assets as well, but you can see that computers, algorithms play games in ways which are clearly price manipulative, both up and down, right? And that destroys the concept of a free and fair price discovery mechanism in a marketplace when you have somebody who's able to whip the price to a point which is not based on a true fundamental bid-ask spread, right? So we've got lots of pieces around that together erode my trust in the markets, of course, because I look at them carefully. Yep. What are your thoughts about, you know, the markets that we do have for gold and silver right now? Are they free, fair, reflective?
Well, from my point of view, the biggest intervention out there is the intervention and manipulation of interest rates, because that's by far the most important price in an economy. Mm-hmm. And, you know, a bunch of Ivy League PhDs setting the price for money and trying to come up with explanations why this and that interest rate level is the right one. I think this is the even more important question that we should ask, but nobody is really questioning central banking nowadays. When it comes to gold, from my point of view, you referred to the you know, the algorithms. I think as soon as we go above this massive resistance, it's 1360, 1380, I think they will switch to the long side again. And from my point of view, of course, there is intervention happening in every market, but we're not only seeing it in the gold market. I think this would be naive to say, you know, the central bankers, they only care about, you know, manipulating the gold price, because, you know, gold was able or allowed to rise from $220 up to $1,900. So where were the manipulators back then? From my point of view, we're seeing interventions in every market nowadays, but I just believe that the market forces are too strong, and that they will at some point they will just overtake those interventions. So for me, I would say it is I think it would be more important to really discuss the consequences of central bank action with QE completely getting the taking the bond market into their custody, also buying equities nowadays, and with their interventions basically completely destroying the pricing mechanism of all markets. Yeah? Just have a look at real estate markets all over the globe. Of course, rising prices are a consequence of interest rates being way too low. And over here in Austria, for example, it is basically impossible for a young family nowadays to buy a home. And there fantastic papers about the consequences of interest rate manipulation and rates being too low. For example, on families, that it's just not due to high prices of real estate. It's not possible to have a big family with three or four kids anymore because nobody can afford so much space anymore within cities, especially. So this is also the reason why we wrote that book, Die Nullzinsfalle, so the zero interest rate trap, because we're not only talking about the financial consequences of the interest rate manipulation, but rather about the consequences for all our lives. And I don't know if you realized it, and perhaps it's mostly a European thing, but it seems that everybody is getting a tattoo nowadays, yeah? So if you walk the streets, there are so many people having tattoos now, and this is, I really don't want to judge anybody. It's everybody should do with his own body what he wants. I'm totally fine with that. But the fact that people are getting tattoos, and I don't know, Chris, do you have a tattoo?
A what? A tattoo?
A tattoo?
No.
Yeah. Okay, but you know, from my observation, after 5 to 10 years, every tattoo looks horrible. It doesn't get any better. It just looks bad. But it shows you that people are only thinking about the moment. They don't care about the long term. They don't care what's going to be in 10 years, in 15 years, and in 20 years. And from my point of view, the manipulation of interest rates really manipulates our time preference. We've got extremely high time preference at the moment, so we don't care about the long term anymore. And this is something that concerns me quite a lot. And this is, perhaps it might sound a bit philosophical, but I think this is something that also is this reason why we're seeing this lack of trust. Yeah, because interest rates are very, very important for the trust in the financial system and in money.
Absolutely. Very well said. And so this brings up an important point. It's interesting to hear about how young families can't get started, can't afford to live in a typical house in Austria. That's true all across the United States. It's true in Canada and Australia. It's true all over the place. And that's thanks to the central banks manipulating the interest rates, setting the price of money, specifically to reward, and I use that term loosely, reward people who already held those assets, but punish the people who need to move into those. Yep. And so they're picking winners and losers, which is a very political act. Another discussion around that later, maybe. But for now, this idea that inflation has been really low, too low, it's a big worry. It's all over the headlines. You know, in fact, I believe it's we're going to have the ECB meeting, and all these headlines came out and said, inflation's just too low. Maybe the ECB needs to do more with QE. But the truth is, if inflation was really too low, people would find it easier and easier to live. My perception is they're finding it harder and harder. So to me, that's because inflation is just simply measured incorrectly or very inaccurately. Where do you stand on this idea of inflation? Because I think we see it everywhere. Inflation's a monetary phenomenon. And wherever you have too much money, you end up with inflation. So where's the money gone? To the rich. Great. Art, which you already mentioned. High-end trophy properties, Gulfstream jets, you know, good luck landing your jet at Davos this year. So lots of inflation right there. But it's also, there's a lot of inflation, I think, for the average person, more than is being admitted. What are your thoughts on this?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. We've got a fantastic chart. And, you know, Chris, we really like long-term charts. It's on page 328 of the report. It shows the income share of the top 1% from 1915 to 2016. So back in 1971, when Nixon temporarily suspended the convertibility of the U.S. dollar.
Yep.
The income share of the top 1% was 10.4%. At the moment, it's 21%, and it is rising big time. So of course we're seeing the so-called Cantillon effect. Those people that are closest to freshly printed money, they profit from it. It is no coincidence that real estate prices in financial centers like Hong Kong, like New York, like London are the highest. It is because those are the financial hubs that profit the fastest from monetary inflation, while I don't know, in some rural areas like what would it be in the US, Alabama, something like that.
Sure.
You're basically, you don't profit really from newly printed money, from asset price inflation. Yeah. You suffer from price inflation. So I think it is of course something that puts enormous pressure on people, and it clearly shows that, you know, if you don't get any interest on your savings account, of course I say, okay, I don't care about it. Just spend the money, buy a new car or a new cell phone, whatever, go on vacation. We are not getting anything on our savings account anyways. And I think when it comes to inflation, we should not forget that at the moment there's roughly 12 trillion, so 12,000 billion US dollars in bonds at a negative yield. And what is the absolute pain trade for those negative yielding bonds? It is inflation. And we have seen Bloomberg Business Week a couple of days ago, they came out with a cover saying, and they showed a dinosaur saying, "Is inflation dead?" And the subtitle was, "A new era has some frightening downsides." And this eerily reminded me of the cover of Business Week in 1979. And the title was "The Death of Equities, How Inflation is Destroying the Stock Market." Mm-hmm. So compared to 1979, when we have seen a decade basically of high inflation and of stagflation, compared to that, the sentiment has completely shifted. And nowadays, it seems that rising inflation seems to be a big contrarian trade. And we should not forget that this is exactly what politicians and central bankers want. Powell just recently said he's very much concerned about the lack of inflation, of course, measured by their own statistics. So they will try everything to get inflation up. And, you know, once the genie is out of the bottle, it's hard to get it in again. So from my point of view, having some inflation hedge definitely makes sense. And we crunched the numbers, and it is clear that commodities, mining stocks, and especially gold and silver are the best hedges in times of rising inflation rates. So if you think that at some point central bankers will succeed with getting higher inflation, you at least have to have some gold in your portfolio.
Well, I agree. I think the central bankers are going to succeed beyond their wildest dreams. You know, let's pick on Japan. They've been trying to destroy their currency for a long time. I think they're going to succeed eventually. And so people are going to be absolutely ruined by that. I happen to believe that a little bit about what's different this time, and I hate those words, very dangerous words in investing, but when inflation comes along, the typical way that the central bank then has to go about combating that is to raise interest rates, which normally meant removing money from the marketplace. Now the Fed's got this other crazy mechanism where they just dial the interest and excess reserves. But if you do have to go out and raise interest rates, I think inflation quickly leads to a financial systemic crisis because when that inflation comes, the system will be crammed right up to its nose with too much debt, and it can't sustain a rising interest rate. So then what do you do if you're a central banker where you have inflation you need to contain, but you've got too much debt to sustain a higher interest rate? There's really nothing to do there at that point in time. So that's why I think that leads very quickly into a systemic crisis. Because I'm a kind of an Austrian economist at heart, particularly von Mises, where he said, you know, you either voluntarily abandon your credit expansion or you face a destruction of the currency system. That's really where this feels like it's heading. It's taken a lot longer than I thought. But is that possibly, you know, where your thesis leads? Is that there is no, we're in a box canyon? It's just a question of, you know, do we smash into the left wall or the right wall? Or do you think there is a way out of this if central bankers suddenly got smart?
Well, the new kid on the block seems to be MMT.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we kind of tried that in the Weimar Republic. It didn't end so well. And I think, you know, the thing that you referred to, that those very, very basic numbers that just don't work out anymore with rising interest rates. I think those are just facts. And we talked about Leslie Nielsen before, and we are quoting Inspector Frank Drebin in the report saying, "Truth hurts, maybe not as much as jumping on a bicycle with the seat missing, but it hurts." And you know, just having a look at the official forecasts by the CBO, the Congressional Budget Office, for the U.S. deficits for the next 10 years. So they see deficits above $1 trillion every year in the next 10 years. But under a very positive or let's say naive assumption that we will see real growth at, I think, 2.8 or 3%, and no recession within the next 10 years. And we're already seeing, you know, that the debt burden is kind of getting out of control in the US, and especially if you compare it to the Eurozone. Just to give you one number, I think this is completely underestimated by my many market participants. If you compare the debt dynamics of the US to Japan and to the Eurozone, there's, you know, it's basically like a crocodile's mouth going up, because the whole combined budget deficit in the Eurozone last year was $67 billion for the whole Eurozone.
Wow.
While in the US it was roughly $700 billion last year. So actually the Eurozone and you know, the Euro gets a fair amount of bashing from all market commentators, but you know, the fiscal responsibility within the Eurozone is much higher than in the US. And it seems that Donald Trump is, let's say, one of the first MMT presidents out there, because, you know, we actually have this prolonged cycle because of this massive fiscal stimulus that we have seen, despite the fact that we have seen record employment and really, really good growth numbers, at least on the surface. But of course, he prolonged it with this massive fiscal stimulus. So from my point of view, over here in Europe, we're seeing that I would say rather extreme populist parties on the left, but also on the right side of the spectrum, are winning most elections. I think that we're going to throw fiscal responsibility aboard because of this, you know, kind of success story of U.S. growth that we have seen the last 1 or 2 years. So from my point of view, this clearly shows that at some point, even the slightest rate increases, and let's not forget that in the Eurozone, we are still kind of in the Mr. Draghi, who will step down in October, he will go down in history books as one of the very few central bankers that did not raise interest rates at least once. He never raised interest rates. He only lowered interest rates, which is kind of odd, because over here in German we say Währungshüter, which is the translation would be a currency watchdog. And if you have a look at the euro since Draghi took office, of course it's down significantly, and this was some sort of, from my point of view, very expensive stimulus for the industry, especially the German car manufacturers and so on. They got an artificial boost, and they created massive overcapacities that at some point, and then we go back to Austrian economics, at some point will have to be restructured, because a recession is only a reallocation of resources. It's something very, very normal within a cycle, but it will hurt. And the longer we try to avoid this recession, the more it will hurt.
All very well said, and I love that you quoted Frank Drebin. In fact, I will say for anybody listening to this that if you want to read In Gold We Trust, you should do it if only for the amazing quotes that have been assembled on the sidebar. You quote all kinds of people. I mean, you know, Janet Yellen, you've got Jim Rickards, but also Homer Simpson. I really appreciate that, to be honest.
Yeah, this is some sort of a hobby of mine, you know, quoting, you know, not only, you know, Roman politicians, but also, you know, John McEnroe. We've got many sports stars. We are quoting some songs. So this is something that also tries to, you know, loosen up the whole material. And, you know, my readers, they invest their precious time in reading our thoughts. So I really want to make this also kind of entertaining, because time is really precious. And therefore we said, okay, let's put some good cartoons in. Let's put in some good quotes and make this really a fun time investing in reading the report.
Well, it's very well laid out. It's very easy to read. And the quotes, of course, really do assist with the whole thing. And it's got I really like the layout. Lots of space. It's very easy to read. And the writing is just wonderful. So I would advise everybody to read it. That's it's got a lot of history in there. But this is really a critical moment in history. This is something that I think, Roni, you and your team are working for. I work for this. A lot of people that you're quoting are working for this, which is this importance of educating everyone to the true conditions of where we are. This is really extraordinary. You know, it's kind of like we're the proverbial fish in water. We can't really see the water because it's around us all the time, so we don't have a concept of it. But this monetary regime that we're under right now has never been tried before in history. It has, but it's blown up in local terms. But this is a global experiment. Everybody's printing like crazy. The idea is that we can just do this forever, and it's all going to work out. And as long as we can keep asset markets inflated, everything's good. But this is really not the case. And to have that solid grounding in history, I think, allows people to see the forest, right? We're in the trees, we're in the water, whatever the metaphor is. But if you can back out and take a peek at it, then you have a chance to plot a way for yourself to not just secure your own financial aspects in life, but maybe those for your family. And because I'm really investing for grandchildren I don't have yet, you know, and really thinking about how I'm going to pass wealth on. And I don't know how to do that if I'm just investing in something I don't believe in. But I'm a critic. Maybe some people listening are skeptics or believers, as you put them. But I think that your report will help move people, nudge people into that realist camp. This is the nature of the world we live in. Monetary experiments, they have pros and they have cons. And we're only ever told about the pros. What are the cons? We need to know those. So that's, I think, a real service. And so, A, thank you for writing the report again. Thank you for your time today. Thank you for making it accessible to everybody for free. And please tell people, Roni, now how they can access the report.
Yeah, thanks, Chris. It is really something where we try to make a slight difference for our lives and the lives of our readers and kind of society, to educate people and inform people about monetary history and how to prepare and how to hedge against extreme scenarios. So this is also the reason why the report is available for free. We should not forget that it is a big team working on the report. There's 15 people working on it. So we're really proud to have great companies that support us. Without them, it wouldn't be possible to put it out for free. We probably will hit 2 million readers for this report, as we're also going to publish it in China for the very first time. And yeah, it is all available on our webpage, ingoldwetrust.report. You can sign up for our newsletter. So there's the In Gold We Trust report as an extended and compact version. But we also have chart books that we publish twice a year. in fall and in early spring normally. And you can find more about our company, Incrementum, which is a wealth manager and a fund management company, on our webpage, incrementum.li. And you can also find me on Twitter. I'm quite active. I'm tweeting out charts, especially, and comments about macro, but also about gold, of course. And my handle is Ron Stoefele. And yeah, so that's it, basically.
Well, fantastic. Well, thank you so much for your time today, and I can't wait to see you again in person at some point.
Yeah, and then we'll have a beer, Chris. Thank you very much for taking the time. I really enjoyed it, and I hope that you and your listeners also did. Thank you very much, Chris.
Thank you, and the pleasure has been all ours.